So, this is the interview for a podcast for my school. As you know, the first one didn't go super well and deleted itself. So this is take two. First one was with my grandpa, Papa Al. This, for everyone listening, is my dad, Dinesh Tandon. He is a public defender for, what would you call yourself? What's your job title?
I work at the San Diego Public Defender's Office. I'm a primary public defender.
All right. So, that's a pretty interesting job, at least I think, because, like, it's not a job that many people would want to take. So, when did you realize you wanted to go along that path?
I think that when I was in law school, I knew that I wanted to help people. And so I was always interested in fighting for those who didn't have power. And I got an opportunity to intern at the public defender's office. So I worked there and fell in love with it. All right. Just the being with clients and in kind of their lowest moments and trying to help them through that. Mm-hmm. It just felt like a powerful thing to do for people.
So I assume everybody knows what a public defender does, but just in case they don't, could you kind of describe what your day-to-day job is?
Sure. There is a provision in the United States Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, the Sixth Amendment, that says that if you're accused of a crime, that everybody has the right to an attorney. There's a Supreme Court case that came out in 1960 that said, and it's called Gideon v. Wainwright, and it says that that right to an attorney exists for everybody, and if you can't afford an attorney, the state has to provide one for you for all criminal cases. So states have to create a system where people who can't afford an attorney get an attorney. There are different ways that you can do that. One of the ways you do that is if the local government creates a public defender's office. And that's what San Diego County did. In 1988, they went from having private attorneys who got paid on an hourly basis individually on cases and that were kind of randomly assigned to an office where the county has hired, you know, roughly 300 attorneys, and we represent people who are accused of crimes that can't afford an attorney. Mm-hmm.
I understand that even if your job title doesn't say it, you're on the higher end of the spectrum of that.
Oh, so in terms of like how long I've been doing it? Mm-hmm. So my official job title actually does kind of talk about what I do. And my official job title is Deputy Primary Public Defender 4. So we have Primary Public Defender 1s, 2s, 3s, 4s, and 5s, and then Chiefs. So I'm a PPD 4 is kind of the shorthand for it.
Okay. That's not that far from the top. You may get there one
day. I believe it's far enough away for right now.
I bet you'll be the chief one day. I can see that.
Well, you know, I don't. It's a great job to be the chief. Would love to do it, but there is something really wonderful about
doing the actual trial.
Doing the actual trial. And chiefs don't get to do the actual trial. So chiefs, they kind of run the office. And they're the ones that are in charge of pretty much what people do. But the people that are below the chiefs do the trials. They are in court day to day dealing with the judges, dealing with the prosecutors who are trying to convict our clients, and get their hands a little dirtier, and I kind of like getting my hands dirty.
Yeah. So when most people think of a trial or a courtroom, they think clean room, there's a judge, the defender comes in, says, "Your Honor," puts their stuff down, and everyone's really formal. I've seen you going into trial. It's a bit different. It's a lot looser. You guys have nicknames, you have running jokes. It seems really interesting. So what's the dynamic like between public defenders, public attorneys,
district attorneys
and the judges? What's that like?
Well, it varies from person to person. There are different personalities involved in it. I can tell you about my own personal view of it. Mm-hmm. We are dealing with, oftentimes, really horrible tragedies. Like, you know, look, murder, rape, child molestation, drug dealing, robberies, like real horrible events. And there's a certain level of darkness that kind of goes with that. And if you dwell in that darkness day in and day out, I don't think you can do that long term without burning out. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to, I like to lighten the mood a little bit, you know, and be friendly with my adversaries. You know, and I do that because I think that it creates a better work environment for everybody. I think it creates a better place for our clients. I think justice is better served when people can come in it with a little bit of a clear mind, where they're not so weighed down by the horribleness of a crime, but you get to look at the full spectrum of what life is. Because even in that horrible tragedy, there are pinpoints of light. And I like to try and draw people towards those pinpoints of light. Mm.
From a young age, you've always kind of told me, like, it's not, when you do something wrong, it's not that you're a bad person. There's no such thing as a bad person. It's a person who's made a mistake. Other than that, what has this job taught you? Because it's a really morally full job. So
yeah, I think it's taught me that there is a complexity to people that you have to work hard to embrace. When somebody does something wrong, it's really easy to say, this person is a bad person. I think it happens in social situations, especially a young high schooler like yourself.
Yeah.
You can have somebody who I don't know, does a really horrible dance move. And people would look at that and go, "Oh no, that's super embarrassing." And the person who does the dance move that's really horrible thinks to themselves, "My life is ruined." Mm-hmm. But in reality, that's not what happens.
Yeah.
On a greater scale, if you commit a crime, I don't think that should define you. That's not your, you know, if you commit a robbery, you are not just a robber. And this is a quote from, I think I've shared this author with you, Brian Stevenson.
What's that book?
Just Mercy. You know, his philosophy, I think, really speaks the truth to what we do, which is we are out there to try and redefine our clients. Our clients get arrested and they are instantly criminals. We have this idea of the presumption of innocence in our country. I don't think that that's really how we view people who are arrested. I think we presume them to be guilty. My job is to remind everyone that this person is a person. They're not a robber. They're not a murderer. They're not a rapist. They're not a child molester. They are a person, and we should be judging the whole person, not just the act that they've done.
Mm-hmm. And also, innocent until proven guilty.
And also innocent proven until proven guilty. Now, you know, and I think I've talked to you about it, that most of my clients plead guilty at a certain point in time. The conviction rate in San Diego is extraordinarily high. People who are arrested for crimes either plead guilty or are found guilty about 90-some-odd percent of the time. So, you know, they might have done something wrong. But, you know, our job is to make sure that the government can prove their case against our client. But even if they do prove that case against our client, that's not when our job ends. Then my client gets punished. They get punished by the judicial system. The judge says to them how much time they're going to spend in jail, what they have to do if they don't go to jail, if they're on probation. And my job is to, before a judge tells my client what punishment they're going to get, to let the judge know who my client is, the whole picture.
Mm-hmm. This has all been kind of like a serious conversation.
Uh-huh.
So, to lighten it up, I know I've heard a lot of great stories from you. What are some of your highlights on the job? Funny moments, little moments of humanity, stuff like that.
Well, you know, it's a tough one because so many have to go appropriate. Weird things happen all the time. You know, we had a client who tried to come into court recently, and his face was covered in blue ink. Don't know why. It could have been because he was under the influence of drugs and he just decided to take a blue marker to his face. It could be that he tried to, you know, steal money from a bank and a blue dye exploded in his face. Nobody knew why, but he just became known as Papa Smurf. And that's just kind of what happened. And, you know, it just I heard about him and, you know, we're in court and he's telling me this story about why he didn't show up to court for one day. It's like he tried to come in, they wouldn't let him in. And it turned out that, oh my God, I'm talking to Papa Smurf. I didn't realize who it was. So that's kind of like a little funny kind of moment that we've had. We get to make fun of all sorts of people. Like, there was this one attorney who called himself the legal baller. And
yeah,
you can Google him. It's kind of ridiculous, but he was a joke. He was a bad attorney and just awful. And we'd make fun of him because he wouldn't wear a tie. He'd wear an ascot to court, and it was just ridiculous. So that's funny for us. But I'm trying to think of a good kind of funny story that would make sense to anybody. Let me give it some thought. Give me another question. I'll come back to that.
All right. Well, we've been talking a lot about like public defenders and that life, but something that's sort of a mystery to me about you is what your life was like when you were my age. I know that you lived in Massachusetts and, but where did you live, Massachusetts and?
I was born in New Jersey, but by the time I was your age, when I was a freshman in high school, I had moved to Tewksbury, Massachusetts, yeah.
Yeah. So what was life like? What was, like, your daily routine?
I was new in high school, so I didn't know anybody. And, of course, you know, I don't think high school is socially easy for anyone. And when you're the new kid in town, and everybody thinks you talk funny, which is really hilarious when you think about how people in Boston talk. it was kind of, I kind of felt a little bit lonely. when I was in high school. I don't think it wasn't until it wasn't until college that I really kind of felt like I had found a place. You know, so I didn't like high school.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think really anyone does.
I know. I hope that that's not like. I mean, I think that. I hear. Well, let me put it this way. I've seen a video of you trying to jump over a garbage can, and I don't think I ever had a lot of fun in high school, okay? So you're already ahead of my game. Mm-hmm. So.
Got a pretty serious nosebleed on that one, but it was funny.
It was funny.
It was worth it. It was. So that was your high school life. What did you do after that?
I went to college at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. I majored in philosophy. I took a year off after that, and ski-bummed at Park City. So took a break for 1 year before going to law school.
You were a dirtbag.
Yeah, sort of. So you've got Uncle Sanjay, who is my older brother. He had a place in Park City, so I lived with him and worked at a coffee shop and skied whenever the snow was good.
Not exactly.
Actually snowboarded, so.
Not exactly dirtbag, but it's close enough.
Close enough. It was a lot of fun.
Do you consider yourself good at snowboarding?
No, God, no. Like, even back then, I wasn't good at it, but I had fun with it. I never was the kind of snowboarder that did, like, the parks. I liked to snowboard in powder and just go down wide open runs. I didn't like doing moguls or anything like that. I just liked doing powder and just kind of floating through the snow. It was very nice.
I think I've kind of inherited that. I like the pure, natural beauty of snow.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tewksbury, Massachusetts to where?
To Park City.
Park City.
And then to San Diego.
Yeah. Just like a little quick segue. What's your story about meeting Samuel L. Jackson?
Okay, so when I was living in Park City, they had the Sundance Film Festival. This was 1995. So I think Pulp Fiction had come out, because we knew who Samuel L. Jackson was, so I think Pulp Fiction had to have come out. Mm-hmm. And I was working in a movie theater, and we had this awful uniform. We looked like losers. There was like this plastic neon green and yellow, and it had like a cartoon cat on the front of it. So we were the least cool people in the world. Mm-hmm. And up comes Samuel L. Jackson, who is inarguably the coolest person in the world.
Still is.
And he walks up to the counter, and me and my friend were just frozen, just staring at him. And he's just ordering popcorn and a drink, and he changed up like the size, like he went from a medium drink to a large drink, and it was just like, yeah, of course you would go to a large drink, you're that cool. and we got to serve him popcorn and a drink, and I peaked early, because that's a highlight of your career. I served Samuel L. Jackson a popcorn, and it was going to be a medium soda, but it turned out to be a large soda. And it was very cool.
You could have just retired then.
Right.
Honestly.
Yeah. There's not much more you can do.
Yeah. Well, after Park City, what'd you do? Where'd you go?
After Park City, I came here to San Diego, and just got ready to go to law school. Started law school, and that's when I met your mom.
Mm-hmm.
We were in the same law school class, and we started dating after Halloween.
Mm-hmm. So, you studied philosophy.
Yeah.
What was going to be your trajectory on that? What were you thinking of doing?
I think I always thought I was going to go to law school. When I started taking philosophy, I don't know if I was ready to go to law school. Like, I didn't want to go to more school. So I thought to myself, well, maybe I'll take a break and I'll go to grad school and try and become a professor or something like that. But that was never more than a fleeting thought. It was always geared towards going to law school.
Mm-hmm. You've known what you want to be from the beginning?
Yeah, and even like, when I get, you know, to bring it back to, like, why did I do it? When I was in high school, I did a mock trial team, mm-hmm. and I really enjoyed it. So I thought to myself, maybe I'd make a good lawyer, and I'd want to be a trial lawyer. And the only way to do trials as an attorney and get a lot of trials is in criminal law. And I couldn't see myself being a prosecutor. Like, I couldn't see myself going after my clients the way that prosecutors do. Not that they don't do a valuable service, but mm-hmm. we're better. people in general. I always picture myself helping those who needed help the most. And people who are accused of crimes are really at the lowest low in the world. Mm-hmm. And they need the help the most. So that's kind of, starting in high school, I started thinking that's what I want to do. When I was in college, I started losing focus of that. But once I got into law school, that's when I knew mm-hmm. that I wanted to continue on that path.
Yeah. You haven't had many hiccups, have you?
I think that there, you know, yeah, there have been hiccups along the way. Thankfully, nothing really major. I mean, it took me a while to get hired at the public defender's office because it's a highly sought after job. They don't open up positions all of the time. I didn't get hired in the first round of interviews. I was kind of like the second pick. But and then as I've been going through it, you know, I've had days where everything's going great, and days where judges are yelling at me, and days where I thought that my client was going to get a better result than they did. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the first time your client goes from out of custody and put into handcuffs is a really painful moment. You feel like you failed that person. The first time you have a client get life in prison, it's a very painful moment. You feel like you've really, like, ultimately failed that person. And that's happened to me. Those things have all happened to me. And it takes some time to heal from those wounds, and they don't go away. They're very scarring. Like, you remember those moments.
Mm-hmm. Well, our high school, I think in junior year, does an internship. Have you ever had anyone from our high school intern at your office?
Not from the, I don't think from High Tech International, but High Tech's Media Arts has somebody. In fact, there's somebody who's going to come meet with one of my colleagues, I think either today they met with him or tomorrow. I can't remember when.
Hmm. But, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's a little hard to do. It's a little hard to intern as a high school student, because you guys are all underage, and you can't go into the tanks. You can't go see our clients when we go into the jails, because you're not, like, that's not considered a safe place for minors. Secondly, judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys swear all the time mm-hmm. in court, and like we have to like nobody and nobody edits when they see like somebody, like they don't ask, hey, are you under 18, should we not drop the f-bomb here?
And, I mean, let's be honest,
oh, you guys swear more than we do, we get it, but but it's like, you know, we're supposed to be like, you know, role models or whatever, and you know, it becomes like it's hard to have somebody intern, because how do you, like, when you're interning with our office, I would want you to see what it's really like. But if you're a minor and you're following us around, and we're like, this person, and, you know, it's like, so it becomes, it becomes a challenge to try and you know, show what that's like.
Yeah. So for my last little bit, I know that there's a issue that you're quite passionate about, and I'm gonna give you a little time to rant on it. Do you have anything to say about the new courthouse?
So here's the thing. They spent a lot of money on this new courthouse. And they didn't ask anybody what would make it work. And it doesn't work. Like, it's my main complaint about it, and I could go on for hours and hours about what's wrong with it, but my main complaint about the new courthouse is that it treats our clients like they're not people. They're behind glass walls now. They're not in the courtroom during most of the criminal proceedings. During a trial, they're sitting at our table. They're there. But if they're pleading guilty, if they're, getting sentenced in front of a judge, they're separated from them by a glass wall. I think that that causes a problem. I think it dehumanizes our clients to such a high degree that it becomes easier to imprison them. Mm-hmm. It becomes easier to send somebody away when you think of them as less than you. And we spent $555 million as taxpayers to make our clients feel less than human, and I hate it. If I could tear that place down brick by brick, I would.
Mm-hmm. Well,
rant over.
Luckily, you're going to have a lot of attention to that, because there is a public platform, so
yeah,
who knows, maybe you'll get somewhere.
I would love to be able to challenge some of the things that are happening with our clients, but that decision is above my pay grade. Maybe when I'm a chief someday.
Maybe when you're a chief. All right. Well, I think that's pretty much all the time we have. Ooh. Yeah. So, all right.
All right. Thank you very much.